from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll have a special extended interview with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra's maestro Christoph Urbanski.
And I'll talk with writers and filmmakers Marcus May and Caleb Nunez about their new play. Plus, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR.
The Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra recently unveiled its 86th season of classical pops and family series concerts, which runs from September 2015 to June 2016. In his fifth season with the ISO, music director Christoph Urbanski has programmed a mixture of masterworks by Beethoven, Brahms, Shostakovich, and Tchaikovsky. And after this season's successful multi-week festival based on the music of Russian composers, Urbanski has created another three-week musical celebration in the 2015-2016 season, this time with a celestial theme. From January 22nd through February 5th, 2016, the ISO's Out of This World Cosmos Music Festival presents Holst's The Planets, classical works from the film 2001 A Space Odyssey, and masterpieces by Mozart, Beethoven, and Stravinsky that were included in a time capsule on the spacecraft Voyager in 1977. Travis DiNicola had the opportunity to sit down for a special long interview with Maestro Urbanski to talk about how he creates a season.
Maestro Christoph Urbanski, it's a real pleasure to finally meet you and have you in our Art of the Matter studio. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, this has been quite an exciting couple of weeks for you. The new season for the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra for 2015-2016 has just been announced. And some really exciting things that are a part of that that I want to ask you about in just a moment. But before we get to that, what I'd like to start with is, as a music director, what does it mean to create a season like this? How do you go about it? And I mean, things I wonder about, and I'm sure listeners do too, I mean, how much consideration do you give to works that you've always wanted to conduct? How much consideration do you give to what you think the local audiences want? And then also, how much consideration do you give to what's the best way to really showcase or highlight the musicians of the ISO by picking music specific for them? I mean, all those things must come into play to some extent, but how do you go about it?
Well, there are many important aspects of how I start programming a new season. But as you said, my personal preference, well, that's not really important for me. Of course, I have a list of pieces I wanted to do, but I think there are two aspects that are much more important. The first one is the growth of the orchestra, and I'm always trying to program pieces that are challenging for our musicians, and they could hire the bar of our performances and to make the orchestra sounds better and better every season. Then another aspect that is very important for me is our audience expectations. Well, I know that that people have different tastes, and even though we present the classical music, but classical music is actually, it contains so many different styles and types of music.
Sure.
So I'm trying to make our programs very diverse, you know, to please different tastes of our listeners.
Looking back on your past seasons, and you've been here since the 2011-2012 season as music director, what do you think was a real highlight, something that you're really proud of that you selected and programmed both for the orchestra and for the community?
But you mean in the past?
Yes, in the past, yeah. One that really stands out for you is maybe even a surprise, that something that you picked to do those things to both challenge the orchestra and please the audience, but it turned out even better than you expected.
Well, it happened several times when I was surprised with both the orchestra and the audience reaction, but that one is quite significant. I always see it as an experiment when I've decided to perform Gorecki Symphony No. 3, a symphony of sorrowful songs, which is so different than any other piece of classical music. It's, like a symphony of sorrowful songs. It's mm-hmm. very sad, and it's very slow, and it's, on the other hand, super, super simple. It's a minimal music. And so it actually, for instance, imagine the third movement of the symphony that lasts for over 20 minutes, when for 10 minutes, orchestra plays just one chord and repeats it 5 million times. It, you know, it's so easy actually to lose the tension mm-hmm. of the music on the meaning of it or direction. So it required actually so much concentration and focus from our musicians. But you know, before we did the concert, and obviously during rehearsal, I explained why did Gurecki went for such an extreme simplicity, and what is the meaning of all it. And I couldn't believe, actually, because, you know, I actually consider this music as a very deep, because all the symphony is about all three movements. They include different texts, but each of the texts is about a loss mm-hmm. of a child, which obviously is a very sad situation, you know, and I'm trying to imagine. Well, I cannot imagine because it never happened to me, but I'm trying to imagine a situation, you know, losing a child. So I don't think that there is any more sorrow that could happen to anyone than this particular situation, which is probably the worst that could happen, you know. So if you have this perspective, and I did mm-hmm. say few bits to the audience and telling them, like, look, we're about to hear something very different that we ever presented. Well, it was an experiment, but I had, well, so many comments from both our audience and from the orchestra that they were actually, well, many people said that, well, that piece simply moved them. And it is very moving music. So, well, I was surprised that it was so well received.
That's great. It's important, I think, I mean, to challenge the symphony and the audiences and yourself with choices like that. And that's terrific that in that case it was well received. You've brought a lot of interesting, as I said, choices to Indianapolis since you've been here. And I think next season is another great example of the choices you've been making as the music conductor. Let's talk about what you're bringing next season. One thing that I'm particularly excited about is a grouping of concerts around a theme, around the theme of the cosmos. This is in some ways kind of similar to the Russian festival that occurred just recently this year, that was very successful. Tell me a bit about your choice to have this cosmos theme.
Well, so we just finished our first ever festival when mm-hmm. we've decided to present music of Russian composers. And I'm very happy, actually, that it was so successful, and we get so many great comments about it and about this idea, because actually it was not only symphony concerts, it was lots of chamber concerts and other activities, you know.
Yeah.
So altogether it was great. And, well, it's since I was maybe, I don't know, 13, maybe 14 when actually, because I started my musical studies when I was 12. So I was already doing classical music, and then around 14, 15, I discovered science. And, well, it's a really big deal for me, you know. And the science and music, these are two things I love the most, probably. And I was always very, very much interested in particular, in cosmology mm-hmm. and astronomy. So, but I had to choose. Well, I was always actually dreaming to become a scientist, a cosmologist preferably. But I choose classical music, of uh-huh. course. I do not regret that because, you know, even being conductor, I can do something great, like a festival of music based on the same topic, which is cosmos. So for me, it's a simple dream come true. The two things that I love the most. And, cosmos is, well, actually, You know, if you go a little more philosophical, mm-hmm. I think you might consider music as the universe, because it does not exist, really. I mean, it's so abstract. I think this is the most abstract form of art of all. So many composers realize that, and they are actually every piece of music could be considered its own universe. Like every piece of music that happens to be created in, for instance, Beethoven Mind, his Fifth Symphony, it's a complete universe. And especially that it's created out of nothing. Mm-hmm. He doesn't need anything material, to create it, because it exists only in his mind. Of course, we have performance, we have notes on paper, and they make this abstract thing exist during performance, and they pass it to the viewer, to the listeners. And, well, so altogether, this festival is something I'm actually very proud of, and I hope it will be well received, because we are planning to do concerts on two topics. One is music in cosmos, mm-hmm. and then cosmos in music. So these two perspectives. So cosmos in music, I see as all the inspirations from that topic that inspired composers. Like, for instance, Gustav Holst wrote a cycle of several movements, each in his kind of biggest symphony work, when he describes each of the planets. But this is mainly inspired by astrology.
Mm-hmm.
But it, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, when I first heard that there was going to be a music series based on the cosmos, I thought, okay, well, you know, of course you've got to have the planets, and it's great to have 2001. But I think the most interesting choice of music that's in here are the pieces of music that were also included in the Voyager time capsule.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes back to what you were saying in terms of music being its own, you know, in a way, its own language, its own universe. Or else why would the scientists who put that music on the Voyager time capsule do so? I mean, they were yes. kind of anticipating this, like, universal language of science and sound, right?
No, I think it's much more, actually, the universal language. Because imagine that it happened in the future, that this capsule arrived somewhere and someone or something reads that message. Because mm-hmm. there is on this golden record, there is a very precise description how to listen to it and how to get all the data from this record. So, and they're listening to it. I'm trying to imagine what would they think of us as humans listening to first movement of Beethoven Fifth Symphony, which is so perfect. I consider the complexity of our brain, you know, the fact that there were humans, or we as a humans, because I consider Beethoven Fifth as one of the greatest achievements mm-hmm. of all of us, that we are able to write something that perfect, something that just existed in our mind, and we can make the music, we can put it as waves, as a music on the record, something so abstract, and something that is so perfect. You know, the form of the first movement of Beethoven Fifth Symphony, I consider perfect. And the music, on the other hand, there is so much more emotions in it, and so many things that makes us human.
Mm-hmm.
So I think these people would consider us gods. And I'm so proud that I'm a human. That's mm-hmm. unbelievable, because our skills yeah. are unlimited. Well, there are no limits. I mean, if we could create something so perfect like Beethoven Fifth, well, I'm so proud, actually, that this music is there somewhere. And, of course, no one can answer. And I'm not sure if anyone would ever be able to answer if there is any other life forms apart from those who are existing on Earth or not. It's probable. You never know. Of course, it's a different discussion. So,
sure. So at the same time, I'm never going to be able to listen to Beethoven's Fifth in the same way after the way you just described it. I mean, I think that's very exciting. I think that the audiences, in approaching Beethoven's Fifth from that perspective of, you know, thinking, you know, why was this included in Voyager, and how does this tie into these other pieces that Urbanski has chosen for this out-of-this-world cosmos festival? It's, I think it's just going to be terrific.
Well, yeah, and it's important, actually. You know, of course, well, we can talk philosophically about the meaning of art and the meaning of music, but I think this connection with this Voyager and everything I just said, I think I found it very exciting. And, you know, when I was thinking myself on why did they select those pieces or whatever else they would select. I mean, there are so many more pieces. You know, if they would ask me for advice, I could I could give them so many other pieces that I consider perfect that show us as humans in the best light, in the best perspective.
Okay, so, then I'll ask you, what would be one piece you would select?
Well, to be completely honest with you, I would include Beethoven's Third Symphony, not the Fifth. The Fifth is, well, mostly popular, and everyone recalls it because it's such a popular piece. But I think if we are talking about a form of a symphony, like not only one movement, because they included only the first movement of the Beethoven Fifth Symphony, but symphony, like most of the symphonies are four movement pieces of art. So if you think about entire cycle, in my opinion, Eroica, Beethoven Third Symphony, is the greatest symphony ever written. And this is my personal perspective. I just like it more than Fifth. Maybe the first movement of Fifth, of course. It's perfect itself. But if you talk about all four movements, well, you don't have so much dramaturgy and direction in the meaning that you have in his Third Symphony. So, well, I might do slight alteration. I was never asked. Actually, I was not born yet when the capsule was sent in the universe. So my personal opinion does not count. But still, what is on this record? This is Beethoven Fifth. For instance, imagine. Okay, so being an alien, listening to this. Okay, after listening Bach, because there are some pieces of Bach, which we're also going to present. There is Second Brandenburg Concerto.
One of my
favorites. They would understand how logical it is. Okay, so these humans, as they call themselves, they created a language out of abstract waves, you know, and they could understand it after listening to Bach. Okay, with Beethoven, they would probably understand that they use it as the way of expressing themselves, okay, because there is just so much more tension and so much more emotion. But imagine also included on the record is the sacrificial dance from Rite of Spring, which is, well, vulgar, and it's impossible to understand. Even actually for people who are trained in music, they consider it a noise. Because it's really sounds like a noise. It's just the rhythm. It's no melody, and it's aggressive. It's different.
Yeah.
So then, well, I'm not sure. I mean, so it makes it even more confusing. So what is the purpose of music? Like, okay, so it was a language in Bach's situation, very clear, mathematical. Then there was some more expression. But then what did Stravinsky do with it? So you can actually really look on classical music or art as on entire universe.
You're listening to a special long interview by Travis DiNicolo with Maestro Christoph Urbanski. This is The Art of the Matter.
Let me ask you this. Obviously, your interests go in many, many different places. And as you said, you had a great passion for science and still do. What did make you choose to pursue a career in music and not science? And also, why did you choose to pursue a musical career as a conductor as opposed to a performer?
Well, I was always dreaming to be a scientist because I used to think that I have to do something good for the world. And it was my personal goal. Like, I admire scientists who discover something. Like, for instance, well, there's so many scientists who discovered something, or I especially admire scientists who can predict the future. Like, for instance, Stephen Hawking, who, I mean, is just a simple example. I mean, who predict that the black holes could evaporate, for instance. It's so new, like, you know, and imagine those minds, those amazing minds, discussing things that nowhere even yet prove that they actually exist. Because many people would say, okay, why am I saying that black holes are not proof? We have so many proofs. No one have ever seen it. and we can calculate and we can estimate that, okay, there is a very great probability mm-hmm. that we have black hole in the middle of this galaxy because of this or that, I mean, and etc. But, you know, there are brains who are talking about the nature of it and how much, how smart you have to be to think about the nature of something you don't even know that it existed. Like, for instance, what Einstein did to our perception of the world. Well, what did Copernicus did for our perception of world, putting, you know, creating the idea of solar system with sun in the center. Mm-hmm. Well, previously, well, it's not that previously people did not believe that Earth is, you know, is...
Sure.
Is, but, you know, it was forbidden. This way of mm-hmm. thinking was forbidden by... But we obviously know what the story is. So, so what is the universe and how we see it? That's the question, actually, because, you know, what we think now, well, in 100 years, might be so much not up to date. Mm-hmm. Well, and they might actually, you know, I'm trying to think about, yeah, this is how we see the past. Well, so altogether, I'm consider myself the happiest man in the world because of many things, but some of this is because I live in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because I know so much more than so many wise people living in 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so much more. And I would love to sit down with Isaac Newton and talk to him. Of course, you know, I'm nothing comparing to this great, great mind. But I think he might be interested in some of the things I already know. He never had an idea about.
Sure.
And this is just simply because I live in this time. And I couldn't be happier. Because, well, I'm just proud that I know so much about the universe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud of humans, actually, that we all know so much about it. And that makes me, as I said, the happiest man in the world.
You have a very scientific mind. But but how... So I'm still curious, though, why did you choose then a musical career as opposed to a science career?
Oh, right. Sorry for not answering your questions.
No, not at all. It's, it's fascinating philosophical. You talk about your concepts on this. And actually,
yeah,
I can see how a lot of your thoughts about
yeah.
science
okay.
and philosophy apply to this. But yeah.
Right. So I started yeah. with doing something important.
Mm-hmm.
And I consider scientists as people who are doing the most important things. Because
yes.
I cannot see anything more important than finding an answer to a question, why? For what purpose?
Mm-hmm.
And how does the universe look? When did it start? For what purpose? Who did create it? These are unanswered questions. So I thought that those who are making little steps in this direction to finding us an answer are those who mattered the most
mm-hmm.
for myself. I think they're really making sense of our existence. But... You know, I just said some philosophical things about music,
mm-hmm.
and these are things I actually discovered, well, like maybe a few years ago. So I think actually that art, you know, thinking of this Voyager thing,
mm.
that art, for instance, music is so important and gives us as a human, puts us in different perspective. Without art or without this Beethoven Fifth Symphony, we would not be as rich as we are. Would not be so proud as being human as I am right now. So I think in that perspective, I think that what I'm doing is still very important. And although I'm not a composer, I'm not creating this music, but without performance, those who sit on stage and passing it, well, composers would not write. They have to write for someone. So I consider myself as one little piece of the mechanism which really in total makes sense. So I think the art, you know, I had a few thoughts about it, and after really thinking about it, I came to a conclusion that art really matters. And I think what all the artists are doing is, well, probably equally important to what our scientists are doing.
Do you remember what the first piece was that you conducted?
Well, it was my own piece.
Yeah?
Yes. I was trying to be a composer at that time.
Mm-hmm. How was that, conducting your own piece?
It was terrible.
And So at that point, did you decide that you enjoyed the conducting, but maybe the composing wasn't the best way to go?
Yes, that's true. So the piece I wrote, well, simply I have no talent to become a composer. And that's how I become a conductor. So because it's not as creative as being a composer, because then you can do whatever you have in your mind. Being a conductor, well, you can only shape something that existed in the mind of the composer. But, you know, since I have so much respect and since I admire those great pieces of music or great pieces of art so much, my task is to get into this universe, which I mean to get into the head of the composer and present this universe the best way I can.
Let me ask you a couple more questions before we go here. I'm curious about one other thing about next season. It's my understanding that you're conducting a Mozart symphony for the first time. Is that correct?
Yes, I have never conducted any Mozart symphony before.
This seems a little surprising, I guess, to me. I would imagine to listeners thinking, well, why not? Or, of course you have.
Well, I did conduct some of his concerti, and I did conduct some of Overtures, but I never, ever conducted the symphony because I was always scared that I cannot do it. So, and I said to myself several years ago that I'll do it only with the orchestra I really know. I really know, and only with the orchestra that really understands what my approach to music is. And then I'll give it a try. And so we'll see.
And obviously, I mean, that orchestra is the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, and that's you've gotten to know them quite well. You travel a lot, though. You guest conduct with many other orchestras around the country, around the world. What is that like for you? Is that, interesting. It's a challenge to, of course, meet new musicians and new cities and new audiences. But do you feel like you learned something from those experiences that you bring back here? Or?
Well, absolutely. No, even you don't have to go far. Working with any orchestra, every orchestra is different, so you can gain a lot of experience, you know. And actually, with many orchestras, I found it very inspiring because I hear, for instance, a solo from any symphony played by, you know, I've heard it so many times, and suddenly once I've heard something new and something, well, like shocking in the, you know, when I hear it for the first time. But then, for instance, I found it beautiful, and then I'm thinking about, well, maybe that's the better way. And of course, this is actually the magic of a symphony orchestra, that you have so many egos on stage and you have made this music all together. So they still hire a conductor, you know, to make everything in order. But you really, well, I think the best way to approach to that is, you know, and this is the biggest task of the conductor, to make all of those individual artists give their best they can. And so for me, it's very inspiring. Like, for instance, I go to one orchestra and I found a beautiful color. Well, I've heard this passage so many times, but for instance, I have never heard it so beautiful with such an amazing change of color or something. Well, and then, well, that is really inspiring, you know? And then I'm trying to find a way how to do it, and maybe I like it, maybe I don't, but maybe I'll you know, rethink my entire interpretation again. And so it's actually great, you know, to have this possibility to see, to work with different orchestras and travel around the world, because thanks to that, I got a lot of inspiration.
Well, I put you on the spot then, and ask you, as you come back though to Indianapolis, what makes our symphony or our audience or our community, what makes it special for you here?
Well, I think it's many things. You know, first of all, you know, by many concerts I've already done here, I notice how sensitive this audience is. And that makes it really special. You know, not every place you can find people who are so sensitive about music. And like, for instance, I already said about the comments I received about after this piece. You know, in some places, like, people would simply cannot understand, you know, this. And and I think this makes it, well, very satisfying for me, because I know that I can program more challenging pieces, you know, and I feel much more freedom than as an artist and as a music director of the symphony. So that's really great. And Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra is the orchestra I work the most of the time, because even though I hold the position in Trondheim, I don't do so many concerts a year with them. So I've been, actually, for me, it's such a comfort, you know, to work with work on something bigger, mm-hmm. with a group of such a talented musicians as our musicians, because normally when I'm guest conducting, I'm going to the place for, I don't know, a few rehearsals and then a few concerts, and that's it. You won't be able to achieve any bigger. You won't change the sound of this orchestra and the tradition. And here, being a music director for the fourth season, I've already noticed, actually, things that are different. And, well, of course, I mean, that's why I have rehearsals, and that's why I'm programming the particular pieces, because I want orchestra to sound in slightly different way. Sure. And step by step, I think it's really going to that direction. So, for instance, last few weeks, when we performed Shostakovich Symphony No. 7. This was my last concert here in Indianapolis before I come back for concerts in the spring. So we did the Shostakovich 7, and from the first rehearsal, I was so amazed. I was like, oh gosh, I finally have the orchestra who is reading my mind. Well, of course, not everything was exactly the way. I need to explain many things, and I need to fix some things, and of course, do my work. But from the beginning, I noticed how much the tension from strings I have for making the sound more sustained, or making the sound more legato, because I love, you know, when the legato lines sound. Legato means like there is like an imperceptible change from one to another note. Yeah. So it's really, it goes very smoothly, and like I very much like the smoothness in long lines in music. And I noticed that, well, wow, this is something I don't even need to remind them about it. Well, which is so good. I've already said it 5 million times, maybe not so many, but many times, and they know it, and it's actually such a comfort for me, you know, to have
that's
musicians.
Great to hear.
Well, and they're very intelligent musicians, so they know what I want, you know, and actually, I think that sometimes they kind of agree with my opinion, and they that's why they are trying to do it, and that makes this work very special, you know, for me. So whenever I come here, it's great
to hear. Yeah. Let me ask you just very quickly one last thing. What's the next concert coming up in March? That
it's going to be all Beethoven, Beethoven 8th Symphony. Well, I would not put that symphony on the Voyager, but it's still amazing symphony. Maybe not the Beethoven most popular, but still, it's actually such a fun piece to listen to. And then together with Alice Saraot, we're going to present Beethoven 3rd Piano Concerto and Beethoven Leonore Overture No. 3.
Excellent. Maestro Christoph Urbanski, it's been a real pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
The pleasure is entirely mine. Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with Maestro Christoph Urbanski of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. To get more information about the ISO and to renew current subscriptions or become a new subscriber, visit the ISO's website at IndianapolisSymphony.org, IndianapolisSymphony.org. Hey, Travis?
Yes, Sharon.
You know what happens this weekend?
Let's see. What happens this weekend? It's the last weekend of February.
Which means we're getting so much closer to spring as that calendar turns to March 1st this Sunday.
Oh, all the daffodils will come
up. All the daffodils will come
up. The sky will open up
in
sunshine.
We might have another foot of snow,
yeah,
but
well,
at least the calendar looks like
we're getting closer.
We're getting closer, and we have things for you to do to celebrate on our calendar. We call
What do we do? Well, I'll tell you, when I start thinking of good weather, I start thinking of road trips.
Yes.
And
vroom, vroom.
Yes. Now, maple syrup isn't exactly what I think of when I think of spring. It's more of a winter thing. Mm-hmm. But we do have our own maple syrup festival, Sharon, and it is coming up March 7th and 8th. And it is taking place in Brown County. And as part of it, they have an event called Art in Action. And this is part of the 2015 National Maple Syrup Festival, let me tell you. And so artists from across the state are then be showcasing their talents as part of this. And they'll be flocking to Brown County. And there's a paint out and exhibits. And there's also going to be lots of the plein air association is going to be out there on both Saturday and Sunday, the 7th and 8th. They'll be setting up so you can watch them paint, and they'll be capturing all the maple syrup festivities. And of course, there'll be lots of maple syrup tastings as well, and lots of other cool stuff too. Actually, the whole festival goes on from the 5th through the 8th. It's the Art in Action takes place on the 7th and 8th. So that sounds like a really sweet and savory way to enjoy a weekend. You can get a lot more information at nationalmaplesyrupfestival.com. Again, nationalmaplesyrupfestival.com.
Hey, something else you'll find out more about in the near future, Claire Welcher. You might know her from many stages around town, Fringe Festival, but in particular doing local comedy sports shows. She's running an Indiegogo campaign through March 2nd because she has this crazy idea of living in an RV, traveling the entire United States, and performing with all the comedy sports outlets around the country.
How cool!
Yeah, so you can go online and just search Claire Welcher Indiegogo campaign, and again, stay tuned. We're having her in for an interview soon, and we'll hear about what this grand adventure will be like.
Very good. Well, since I missed the opening, I'm looking forward to seeing Hound of the Baskervilles at the IRT this weekend. But Sharon, we are out of time already, so you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide. The Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. Or, of course, you can always listen to us next week on
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Filmmakers Marcus May and Caleb Nunez are going low-tech for their new project. Their play, that's right, a play, not a film, Sacrifice, will be produced at the Pike Performing Arts Center on Saturday, March 21st. Sharon Gamble invited the two writers and directors in to talk about the play and their collaboration.
So my big question is, you guys are filmmakers. How did it come about that you wanted to put a work on stage?
Well, it started off, my partner, Caleb Nunez, came to me and basically said, hey, I have an idea about a screenplay dealing with some turmoil between the Puerto Rican and the black, you know, ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
And it just started from there, and then we just started writing. And once we got it finished, we realized we didn't have a lot of locations and we didn't have a lot of characters. And
okay. So...
you know, since I moved back from New York, I was thinking of doing something different. I kind of explored the whole, you know, film narrative type work here in Indianapolis. And I just said, man, you know, a lot of people are doing corporate videos. A lot of people are doing commercials. You know, let's try something different. Let's try to put this on a stage. You know, I went to Indie Friends. We did some investigative type work. And I mean, it just really opened our eyes to everything that's going on with the arts as far as theater here in Indianapolis. And so... it was just born. It just kind of, you know, grew organically from there, and you know, it just turned into a play. And
sure.
It just kind of happened.
It happened. That was its path in the world, apparently.
Yes, it was.
Caleb, tell me about where this idea came from.
This idea came from a question that I asked Marcus. We met up, and at that point, Marcus was working on another script, and he told me, hey, I'm working on something else, but I'll definitely listen to you right now. And this question came about, there's a taboo in the Hispanic society that we either never speak about it or it's untold. And about how racism is not only black or white, you know, it could trickle down to the races that are more common or more closer to each other, like the Hispanic race and the black race.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked Marcus, you know, if he ever felt racism towards him from a Hispanic male or female, you know, considering that he's married to a Hispanic female. And his answer was no at that point. And once I told him that it does exist, it triggered his thought, and he wanted to talk more about it. And that's where it started.
Wow. And how did you meet? How did you come into each other's lives?
So my wife and his wife are cousins, our first cousins.
Okay,
and
got
so
it.
That's when he, you know, had the idea, came to me and asked me about that, if I ever experienced any racism. And I said I didn't, but with the, you know, booming population of the Hispanic and Puerto Rican community here in Indianapolis, I wanted to listen because I thought it was relevant for the time of what's going on here in Indy. So it just kind of happened. It was like a perfect storm, so to speak.
So tell me about the plot of this. Is this based on something that you heard about happening, or is this pure fiction?
Pure fiction. And it's about really the things that happen is... It's about being ignorant. You know, some of the characters are just, they have this thought in their mind. And one of the main characters, Ernesto, who is Puerto Rican, what happens with him is he's affected by his past and he can't let go. His wife was murdered by an African-American male. Mm. And that just causes him to kind of just write, you know, the whole race off. You know, they can't do right. You know, he just has that hatred for, you know, the African-American black people in general. And It just engulfs him. He can't, you know, get past it. And so that's where kind of the story starts. And then we see what ends up happening is a black family moves into the same neighborhood area, and the two kids of these two different parents, they kind of fall in love, and it causes major problems on both sides. So Trey, played by Trent Hawthorne Richards, he, you know, smart kid. Being recruited by all the different universities and everything, really smart academically. And what happens is his father's naive and, you know, notices that he's taking a liking to this Puerto Rican girl. And he's like, you know, you need to be more focused. You know, you can't, you know, why are you talking to that Mexican girl when she's, you know what I mean? So yeah, it's just one of those things where both parents are blinded and ignorant to the other race, so to speak.
Wow. This is the production coming up is the second production. Where was the first production?
The first one was at Theater on the Square, and that was actually October 18th and 19th.
Mm-hmm.
And we just felt like there's so much more to give. We had two sold-out shows, and people we had to turn massive people away.
Wow.
And so, yeah, we've been invited to Pike Performing Arts Center March 21st at 7 p.m., and... you know, that's it seats, you know, 1,400 so
right.
as well.
Well, so there's a question. I mean, you went from Tots, which stage were you on? Second stage or the main stage?
Main stage.
Well, the main stage is pretty petite compared to Pike Performing Arts Center.
Yeah,
so
yes,
as we're having this conversation, have you had a chance to have rehearsals at Pike yet?
Yes, two so far. And then coming up mid-March, we'll go into having our tech rehearsals there and, you know, start fine-tuning everything.
So what are you doing differently as directors and producers to accommodate the change? You're on a physically larger stage in a much larger house.
Right. One thing that we're doing different is the marketing. So with this first one, it was kind of almost like a workshop to play. We kind of just did word of mouth and kind of just friends, family. And it just kind of grew from there. And then that's why we said, man, we need to go to a bigger venue. Plus, our set is awesome. It's designed by a gentleman named Bernie Killian. He did a fabulous job, and he's going to do an even better job since we have much more space. I mean, the
right.
stage is that much bigger.
So realistic sets?
Yes, realistic. And, yeah, so now we're doing all the things you're supposed to do, press releases, coming on your show, just making our rounds.
Listen up, arts administration majors. So what kind of feedback did you get when you did your production a few months ago?
We've had amazing feedback, and I work for the Department of Defense, and there's over 5,000 people that work there, and one of the other actors, Michael Benjamin, he plays Antonio. He's the father of the Trey.
Mm-hmm.
And he works with me in the building. And our feedback from the people that went to see it from where I work was amazing. They wrote a paper on the play, and it came back with everyone sending emails. Where can I get tickets? How can I see the show? And that's where we pushed it again. Hey, we have to show this again.
Yeah.
And no negative feedback so far, you know, and all positive and great, great feedback.
Have you had some people say, yeah, this is something we just don't, you don't see it on TV, you don't really see it in movies, because people tend to put people in big boxes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you have brown skin, you're just all, you know, this is so wrong. But if you have brown skin, there's like one category for that. If you have white skin, there's one category for that. If you have golden skin, there's one category for that.
I had a lady come up to me. She's 50. And she said, I've lived my life for 50 years. And never once did I imagine that this type of racism existed.
Wow.
And she said it was amazing. And during the play, you're going to get all emotions going through your body. You're going to laugh. You're going to cry. You're going to feel every single bit of emotion that these characters, these actors are performing on stage.
Fantastic. So I want to go back to, you're both filmmakers. Film is so different from theater because it has the capacity to do so much more with visuals. Mm-hmm. And lots of times, if you're making a film, it's not that dialogue isn't important. It's just that it doesn't carry the weight that it does on stage. Mm-hmm. Was there any kind of accommodation you had to make where you were like, oh, wait, no, we're not doing this with a montage here. We have to actually have some characters talk.
Yeah, it was definitely a learning experience. I love film. Film is my first passion. Mm-hmm. And actually, writing, I would say, is my first passion. I love mm-hmm. to write. I love to create stories. I love storytelling. So at heart, creating a story, if it was for theater or if it's for film, to me, it wasn't that much different. The sure. only difference was when I first had some people read my script, and I have a bad habit. I keep calling it a screenplay. It's not a screenplay. It's a play, you know. So they told me, Marcus, this still feels like a film.
Why did they think that?
And some of the slug lines I would have in there, some of the dialogue, some mm-hmm. of the things that you just can't do, like you said, in a play versus on film.
Yeah.
And so I had to really train myself and kind of take out and have some people who are really into plays say, okay, now you got this. You have something to work with. This is tangible. You know, great story. The story was always there, but it was the formatting that, you know, I wanted my actors when they first saw it, my stage actors when they first saw it, like, okay, they knew exactly what I wanted, and it was easy for them to you know, give me that performance.
Hmm. So obviously a goal would be to get more productions of this particular play, but has it given you an idea for how you might build on the story to tell more stories or maybe even become a film?
Well, we've been talking about this actually for some time. So the sacrifice has grown so much that me and Caleb have already sat down and kind of already wrote a sequel. And we're in the actually it's going to be up in the Anthoneum December 19th, the sequel of one. So Sacrifice 2 will open then. But it's just, I mean, these characters, it's an ensemble cast, great actors. They do such a great job. I just felt like the story could continue. Mm-hmm. It could keep moving on and on and on. So, but in the long run, you know, the way they have, you know, really nailed their performance, I think it would be easy to shoot a film of this.
Sure. How did you find your cast?
Well, a little bit all over. Like he mentioned, one of his co-workers is an actor. He acts around the city of Indianapolis in different churches and different stage plays. And the others, he kind of grew out of referral-based things. You know, I would reach out to different people who are in the theaters here and say, hey, I'm looking for, you know, this particular, you know, Caucasian 40s.
Yeah.
And they would, you know, send people over Facebook. Actors, audition actors, I think, is a website.
Indian auditions? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it took a while, but, you know, we stuck to our guns. We weren't going to force it. We wanted to make sure we get the cast that we wanted, and it turned out to be fabulous.
Fantastic. What do you want people to think or say or do when they come out of the theater after seeing this show?
That they'll come back and bring other people. That's one of the comments we've gotten already that we've received, that they've seen it already. Most of the people that already have seen it
mm-hmm.
have already bought tickets for them and either a family member or a cousin or a sister because they want to bring a family member to show them. For any reason it is, they want to bring someone else to share this with them.
That's a high compliment, you guys.
Yeah.
And I would say that anybody that goes, enjoy it, love it, share it, you know, and then we'll continue from there with two and make sure you get out there to see it now on March 21st, because from there we go to two. We're going to play Sacrifice 2 in December.
Sharon Gamble with Marcus May and Caleb Nunez. Their play Sacrifice will be performed at the Pike Performing Arts Center on Saturday, March 21st at 7 p.m. For pre-sale tickets, you can visit pikepack.org. That's pikepac.org. Or you can also get more information at maydayfilmworks.com. Again, maydayfilmworks.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll dig into a Gold Rush exhibit at the Idle Jar.
I'll chat with Jim Poyser about his work with Earth Charter Indiana.
And I'll find out about some special foodie tours of Central Indiana. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.